Hey everybody, welcome to Treetop Talks. You got Andy Sherwood over here.
This is Jay Halasek.
Yep, and our episode this time is going to be focused on propagating trees, and our species highlight will be green ash, Fraxinus pennsylvanica.
It was actually in our woody tree identification class, the first tree we learned about.
Yes, it was.
It's a really great one, and we're going to make you fall in love with the green ash today. First,
it's an awesome tree.
Propagation of trees. Yeah. So maybe let's first kind of talk about what that even means.
Yeah, so propagating trees is making more trees. Because, I mean, we learn, you know, the only thing that's better than few trees is a lot of trees.
Yes.
So, to turn a few trees into a lot of trees, you need to propagate them. So, let's start off maybe with the two main divisions in propagation that we can do. We got clonal propagation, or we have seed propagation.
Right.
Seed propagation is going to give us genetic diversity, which is great in a lot of situations. But in other situations, clonal uniformity is going to be preferred, like in a production setting.
Right.
So do you want to maybe go into the
clonal
options that there are?
Clonal is also known as vegetative propagation sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that refers to one of the ways you can clonally propagate something is by cuttings. You take a few nodes and a little bit of stem tissue off the plant, and you put it in soil, and you put it under mist, and then it grows roots. Now this isn't how trees prefer to reproduce in the wild. They prefer seed propagation.
Yeah, cuttings work much better for other types of plants.
Right, vegetative. A lot of the bedding plants you see, or a lot of the poinsettias you buy, are started by cuttings. Mm-hmm. Because they're easy to root. Woody plants, on the other hand, are not as easy to root.
Yes. A lot of the shrubs are cutting propagated, but
they are still propagated. They have means of doing
it's just
it now,
but it's a little more difficult. Yeah, and trees though are much more difficult to root by cuttings.
Right.
However, there's one tree that's super super easy to root by cuttings.
Yeah, there is.
And that's the weeping willow, or the white willow.
That's because because the willows are just such a soft wood.
Mm-hmm. Soft and flexible.
Right.
So if you just take a branch tip of that and you can stick it in some soil, keep it moist, it'll root within a week, even a few days possibly.
Yeah.
And then you'll start to see some new growth once they have roots on it. It's really encouraging. That's one of the first trees that I propagated. And I thought it was amazing how fast it just took off. And they're really amazing fast growers. So, yeah, but most trees don't, though. That's an exception. Most trees need to be propagated in other ways besides cuttings, just because it's so inefficient. And that's where grafting comes in. Grafting is a broader term that means bringing two plants together to grow as one plant. And this is done typically with what's called a rootstock and a scion. The rootstock is exactly what it sounds like. It provides the roots of the plant. And the scion just means the top half of the plant, being the leaves, stems, and flowers and fruits. And this point where they come together is what we call the roots, the graft union, where the two join together. And there's multiple different kinds of grafting, but the one that's most important in trees, or most used in trees anyway, is budding, bud grafting. This happens by cutting the bark and slipping a bud of the scion.
It's kind of like you're making a pocket for the bud.
Yeah.
You know, you have the rootstock and you just kind of cut
slip it in there.
It just slips in between the bark and sits in there, and then it just starts growing as the top half. And
you have to wrap it up with some plastic to keep it moist and everything together until that point.
But that's a very successful means of doing a graft.
Mm-hmm.
Like Andy said, it's really commonly used.
Yeah, that's what's used in the industry for production.
And so grafting is most commonly used for fruit trees. Mostly all of the dwarf trees, dwarf apples and plum trees you see, is because they found a way to graft a really productive, short scion onto a rootstock of a dwarf tree. And so it naturally just keeps the tree small then. And they've actually figured out, you know, they have 40% full height, 60% full height, and just everything in between for rootstocks these days. But that's most commonly used for, I think, fruit tree production as opposed to some of the ornamental and evergreen trees that get produced.
Yeah, shade trees or landscape trees, which you would normally buy at a nursery just to plant in your yard or something, those are typically just grafted or budded onto a seedling rootstock. So they'll just grow seedlings until they're big enough and then graft on top the cultivar or whatever variety they want. And then grow it on from there.
It's way less selective than the fruit grafting is.
You know? Right.
The fruit one, you can get whatever you're trying to go for in a tree for size and shape. And it's,
yeah, you have a lot of control over the top of your tree with the rootstock. But in landscape trees, that's not nearly as important. It just has to be an easy-to-produce rootstock, which is seeds.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about seeds a little bit then. Yeah. Actually, that kind of looped right back around.
So this is going to be the easiest way for somebody who just wants to propagate a tree to actually go out and do it. Because seeds
Besides willow cuttings.
Okay, maybe.
But yeah, you want to take the next step, seeds are a great way to start.
So seeds are how trees naturally reproduce usually in the wild. And so they just make tons of these seeds, like the helicopters that fall down from your acers and
they're
everything else.
A little bit different. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I was thinking of something else.
That happens.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you get a lot of these seeds, and some of them need to get special treatments before you can just stick them in the soil and have them grow. And that's where vernalization and sometimes scarification comes into play. Want to maybe tell them a little bit about those two terms?
Yeah. So vernalization is the process where the seed perceives the winter happening and realizes that it's spring once the winter ends. So this happens by a few different things in the seed changing, but the point is that it senses the temperature and it needs to be moist for it to happen. So we can simulate winter by providing those two conditions. We could put our seeds in wet soil and then put that into the refrigerator for a few months, and that will simulate winter being cold and moist, and then when you take it back out, the seeds think it's spring and they'll start to grow. This one is a mechanism that some seeds use in some species to grow, whereas others use scarification, the other term that you mentioned, which is a hard seed coat that needs to be broken in order to let the water get into the seed.
Right.
And this is going to be bigger tree seeds like nuts, like maybe black walnut, I think is going to have.
Perfect example.
Yeah, or a Kentucky coffee tree I know has a physical seed dormancy that needs scarification. So that we need to break the seed coat. There's a lot of different ways of doing that. It's really anything you can do to break that.
I've seen people use knives, files even.
Yeah, I've had success with a file. Yeah. I've used a hacksaw before and make a small little cut.
Depends how thick that seed coat is. Because you don't want to damage the embryo.
Right. You've got to be gentle, but yeah. I've heard sandpaper works sometimes. Yeah.
Right, really abrasive sandpaper.
Yeah.
And so for those processes, in vernalization, like he said, moisture is going to be key. If you Google your tree you're trying to propagate to, you can tell if it needs, you know, one of these treatments.
Right.
Some don't.
It'll depend on the tree.
Right. But if you're doing vernalization, moisture is super important. If you do put it just in your fridge, I recommend checking it still like every week for water.
Oh, definitely. And make sure it's frequently
in a nice, moist environment, because if it dries out, it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like we said, for scarification, you can go about that many different ways, but
just be creative with the seeds you have and
just
understand what needs to happen. You just need to allow the water through that hard coat.
Like to think of it like if you're if you've ever taken the yolk out of an egg before without breaking it, you put a little needle hole in the top so you can just take it out and
it's similar to that, just making as small of a hole as possible.
Just gotta let the water get in there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that covers seed propagation pretty well.
Yeah, well, let's talk about seed source a little bit.
Okay.
Because that's going to matter. If you want a tree that is going to grow really well in your climate, it would be good to get seeds from trees that are right in your area. Because that way you know that they're adapted to that site and they're ready to live there successfully because their parents did. And that's a great option, but then you need to be aware of when the seeds are going to be ripe to harvest. So it's definitely a great way to do it. You're going to have the best quality seeds for your area, but it's a little bit harder to do. So for that, you're going to have to just Google your tree, find out when the seeds are ripe, or watch the tree and just wait for it to happen.
Right.
Watch and see when it happens and collect them. Or look up some information on it, find out when that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But then the easier way to do it...
You'll be able to find that.
Yeah. And then the easier way to do it is going to be just buying seed, which you can buy seed online really easily for just about any trees you get.
Yeah.
You can get really good seed sources. They just won't be particularly adapted to your site.
Right.
But you can find trees.
You might get a little less variety also if you
go online.
There's not... Mm-hmm. They're generally trying to hit a pretty big marketplace, so they use trees that they can easily get a lot of seeds from.
Yeah, which aren't necessarily adapted to your site. You gotta just keep in mind where the seed's coming from if you're gonna buy it.
Absolutely.
But it's not a bad option.
No, it's not. That's if you don't really like going around out in the woods and looking for tree seeds, you know, it's a pretty good option for you then.
It is
cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's good on seeds, and I think let's talk about how trees get produced on a mass scale in the commercial setting.
So you'll start with these seedlings. Like we said, they either, you know, sometimes graft them, sometimes it is seed, and then sometimes it's cuttings. So you get a little seedling, nice little root system, and then that's usually up-potted into what we call a 1 gallon pot. From there, it's grown for the rest of the year, and then it's overwintered. Up here in the north anyways, we overwinter trees.
Yeah.
So that involves tipping the tree on its side, covering it with hay, straw or something, and then putting a white reflective tarp over it. And we've done that on a large scale. It's not the most fun thing in the world to tip over.
It's really effective though.
A couple thousand pots and then cover them with hay, but it works super well, and it's very important because otherwise they'll die in that pot.
Right. What that does is insulates the root systems and kind of keeps them just as warm as they would be if they were underground over winter.
Because the tops of the tree, as long as they get covered by snow, is not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the root system is a lot more sensitive, so for temperature control, they do that. So when they wake up then in the spring, they'll either continue to be grown out, they'll be up-potted, if they're going to be grown in a pot for their final...
Yeah, if they're going to stay in a pot until they're sold.
Right, if they're going to be sold as a potted tree, they'll put them into another pot. Otherwise, a lot of times after the first year, they'll field plant them then.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to be dug as maybe a whip or a ball and burlap tree, commonly referred to as B&B.
Yeah, and even sometimes they're planted as seedlings in the field and then grown out to that bigger size, into that... you know, into a whip, which just means a tree without branches on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be a one-year whip, probably, one or two maybe, depending on the tree.
Yeah.
Then they'll dig that out and space them out a little bit more, and until they're bigger, you know, more branched, and then...
And so this whole process takes, you know, usually 3 to 5 years, depending on the tree, before you get it to something that you see in Lowe's or wherever you buy your trees from, hopefully a local garden center.
Yeah.
It's really quite the planning process. We've both worked at a commercial nursery, and it's incredible the amount of labor and planning that goes into growing trees, you know, if you want to do it well anyways.
Right. Both on the propagation side and the growing on afterwards before selling to produce that bald and burlap or bare red or potted tree. Both aspects require a lot of planning and cooperation between a lot of
members. And I never
members.
Explained what ball and burlap is. Let me quick explain that. So what that is they'll come in with this tree digger machine when the tree is in the field, and they'll dig up the tree with a ball of soil around it. So you'll have this, you know, 200 to 500 pound, depending on the tree.
And the balls, size.
Yeah, and the size. You'll have that giant ball of soil on the bottom. They then wrap that in burlap and then a metal cage of some type.
Yeah, a basket.
Yeah, a basket. That's probably a better word for it. And they do that to keep the roots stable, and then they can transport it and just plant it just like that with the burlap and
right.
basket on it, and the tree will just grow from there. that's what you commonly see for landscaping, because you can get bigger trees right away.
Mm-hmm.
When you do get to a point, though, there's a lot more transplant shock, and
right,
some of the bigger trees don't grow for a very long time after that happens.
The bigger the tree is when you transplant it, the longer the transplant shock will be. There's a rule of thumb in the industry that for every inch of tree caliper, which is the diameter at the base of the tree, for every inch that it is across, there's going to be 1 year of transplant shock.
Mm-hmm.
So if you plant a two-year-old tree, it's not going to grow much for 2 years while it recovers. If you plant a six-inch tree, it's going to be shocked for 6 years. It's not going to grow at all. But you'll have a large tree already during that time. So it's a trade-off.
It is. It is. A lot of people like that instant look nowadays.
Yeah, definitely.
It is definitely still a huge industry out there that not a lot of people know about probably these days, because most of the trees you find in your garden centers are going to be potted because they're so much easier to move around.
Right. Easier to handle for everybody, really.
A lot less soil. Yeah. We should
talk about bare root, though, actually. Bare root trees are a really great underutilized option.
Yes.
They're literally what it sounds like is just a tree with its roots bare.
Mm-hmm.
They just dig it out and shake all the soil off of it.
Wash it off.
They do this while it's dormant, and then you have to buy it while it's dormant. That's the biggest limitation, is the planting season.
Mm-hmm.
You can only plant right away in spring or in the fall after the trees have gone dormant. And so it kind of makes it a little bit harder to use. That's why they're not quite as popular. Whereas a potted tree, you can plant pretty much any time of the year, whenever you can dig the ground anyways.
Yep.
And
the ground's unfrozen.
Yeah. But with bare root, you're a lot more limited. But I think even still, if it's springtime or fall and you're trying to plant a tree, bare root's going to be a much more cost-effective option with just about as high as quality.
Right.
So it's just something to keep in mind, yeah.
It's a lot more affordable for shipping because it's a lot lighter weight.
It's just the tree itself, no soil or potting media.
You'll see a lot of the guys, the landscapers who grow their own trees, will plant bare root in the spring, and they'll get bundles of 5 to 15 to 20 trees in a bundle and just have all the roots out like that and then go and plant them right in the field.
Yep.
So it is another option, but it is a... It, like you said, timing is a little bit more critical, and I think that turns a lot of people off to doing it, because
it does.
We like convenient stuff.
Exactly, yeah. But if it's, you know, if you have the opportunity, if it's springtime and you're planting a tree, say for Arbor Day or something like that,
bare root is a tree, that's for sure.
Yeah. Bare root's definitely the best way, because then you can plant more trees with less money.
Right. And who doesn't like that?
It's a win-win, really. The right situation, bare root's the way to go, in my opinion. So I think it's time to move on to green ash here.
Species of the week, Fraxinus pennsylvanica.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
All right. Well, I think it's only fair to mention, when we start off talking about green ash, that there's a big insect pest rolling through right now called the emerald ash borer.
Yeah.
It's actually going to be our topic for the next episode.
It is.
This is kind of a little introduction to that.
We're going
to
get you all intrigued, but
we're not going to go too deeply into emerald ash borer right now. We're going to focus on green ash because this is our species highlight.
Basically, what you need to know is emerald ash borer is the equivalent to Dutch elm disease, but for green ash.
And it's an insect.
And it is an insect and not a fungus.
But causing the same kind of damage,
massive amounts of death whenever that insect comes through, and it's on the move.
There's still some communities that have 80% of their trees that are ash,
and
which almost all of them are dying, leaves them with only 20% the amount of trees they had.
So let's talk about why they planted 80% green ash, because this is a really kick-ass tree. It's got a lot of good things going for it. It can grow almost anywhere. What's its native range, Mr. Sherwood?
It's just about all of North America.
Right.
With the exception being the West Coast, essentially, and a little bit inland. Looks like to the Rockies by looking at this map, roughly.
It can grow in a well-ranging variety of soils. It is naturally a riparian tree, so it it doesn't mind it being a little bit wet or a little bit dry.
It's okay with a wet, compact soil.
Yeah.
It's okay with, you know, it tolerates a wide range of soils. It's super hardy, zone 2, mm-hmm. all the way down to zone 9, so it covers, you know, almost all of the U.S.
It's got really good form, too. That was a big reason why they planted it in all of these cities, is because it does have a very tall, upright form with a big canopy of
an upright oval.
Right.
Provides dense shade, thick shade.
That's partly in due to, we can talk about its leaves and stems here.
Yeah.
Its leaves are opposite, and they're pinnately compound.
I don't know if we've ever used that word before. Yeah, let's
describe
that.
This is going to be difficult. Oh, it'd be so much easier. You know what, guys? Go and Google pinnately compound leaves.
Let's do this.
We can give you a brief description, but it'll be...
There's leaflets that are... they go back and forth next to each other with one on the end.
Yeah.
It looks kind of like a ladder, maybe.
And so
is the best I can come up with.
Each one of those individual little leaflets is not like a leaf, but all of them on that stem
together is the leaf.
And then
is there nine of them on this tree?
There's six. Let's see. No, it's 5 to 9, and usually 7. I'm seeing here.
Okay.
So it's
gonna
very
be an odd number.
Yeah. It's a very big leaf is the point, so you get a lot of shade with this tree.
It looks like it's a lot of leaves, but it's one big leaf.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the fall color is yellow, so, I mean, it's pretty interesting.
Good.
Yeah, it's not...
There's a couple different shades of yellow, but it's not...
A little bit of variation there.
Not as out there as a maple,
it's not super striking, but it's a nice...
For a boulevard tree, it looks pretty nice.
It does, yeah.
It's got a really cool bark, too. Its bark is like this cool, thin, furrowed diamond shape.
Yeah, I think that's the most distinctive. Yeah. It makes this diamond pattern
it's
on
super
the bark.
Cool.
If you just... I find myself recognizing green ash just by... I see a tree with diamond-shaped bark, and I'm like, that must be a green ash. Look up and look at the leaves.
And it's fun because if you can identify it, you'll start noticing that it is planted all over the place.
Yeah,
they
very, very
heavily used
here.
That tree after... when Dutch elm disease came through and took out all of the elms, what they replaced those with was green ash.
Green ash was their go-to tree.
Because it grew so well in a city. Like we said, it's got that dense shade. They just, again, they had a monoculture outbreak. All the trees are gone. So what did they do?
Planted another mostly
monoculture.
The same.
that's, again, diversity.
Yeah.
You will find a lot of these trees everywhere.
Another cool thing I think is they're dioecious, and that means that the male trees and the female trees are separate trees. So the male trees have male flowers on them, the female trees have female flowers on them. So it's interesting, you'll find the male flowers won't have seeds on them because the female trees bear the fruit and the seeds. So it's just, if you're looking for green ash seeds to propagate, you have to find a female tree in order to do so that has been fertilized by a male tree.
Okay. And so, that is kind of cool because
it's
a
unique,
lot of trees are monoecious,
where
both male and female are
on the same tree. Right. So yeah, this is kind of...
It's an outlier for sure.
Yeah,
it's
definitely
not the majority percentage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. So let's talk about its fruit then.
Yeah.
It's got the samaras, which are those winged seeds, but it's a single, and it's kind of like a spatula shape, so it's a single seed, and then it kind of widens out towards the end, kind of like a spatula. It's usually 1 to 2 inches long, and they're usually in clusters, which is pretty distinctive.
Yeah, and they got, maybe a half inch wide, quarter inch wide,
half inch to a quarter inch wide, and they can stay on the tree all winter.
Yep, and they'll just fall off and blow away,
right?
If they, when they do fall off.
So once you find this tree, you can go collect seeds from it.
Yeah, this is a great one to propagate because at a time like this, where the species is being so strongly challenged and threatened by herbal dash borer, it's really important to maintain genetic diversity.
Seed is a great way to do that.
Yeah, seed is the only way to do that, really. Dutch elm disease killed most of the elm, and the only ones that are left now are the ones that are resistant, and they're being replanted. that's our option for green ash, is we need to find those resistant trees that have resistance to emerald ash borer. They exist somewhere. I obviously have no proof of that, but I believe it exists somewhere. It did in elm, and I think it does in ash. I think we know it exists in the other species of ash, which we'll talk about this maybe a little bit more on our next episode when we go more deeply into emerald ash borer. But just trying to make the point that it's super important to preserve the genetic diversity, collect seeds. This is an important tree to propagate by seed if we're going to propagate it at all right now.
Absolutely.
So reasons to grow this tree again, I mean, the wood is really, really useful. It is. Really nice hard wood, a lightish color with, I think it's got a relatively fine grain, so it's not... It's super hard. It's good.
It's not really like oak or anything.
Yeah, it's not super distinctive. It's just like a really nice wood. It's used for tool handles a lot because it's so hard, and it's used for woodworking a lot. I like to turn things on a lathe, and yeah, ash is one of the best woods for that because it's so hard and fine grained.
It's cool because they're
worked really well.
Because they're so upright, also you end up with a large trunk generally, and so you have a big piece of wood that's relatively straight.
Yeah, with few knots in it, because there's not usually a lot of branches low.
Yeah. So it's super useful.
Yeah,
and then
it is.
In that respect, you can.
Great firewood as well.
But we should. Hard. You know, let's mention this as long as we brought firewood up.
Oh yeah.
So
definitely.
You might see signs that say "Don't move your firewood" or like people with bumper stickers like "Don't move your firewood, it bugs me." So. Here's the theory behind that. Insects that, like the emerald ash borer, are really, they live in between the, we'll call it the wood and the bark, for just general purposes. They live between the wood and the bark. And so when you cut a tree down, the insects will still live in between that space until there's no longer food, which can be for a very, very long time.
Well, even if the tree's already dead, if you cut down a tree, even if it's not ash, if you cut down a tree and leave the bark on,
this is just
they still can bore into there and live in those logs after you cut the tree down.
And so
it's important to take the bark off of your logs after you cut a tree down. Or if you have firewood, or if it's going to be turned into lumber, just take the bark off right away. And then no beetles of any kind can be living in there without you knowing about it. Or I guess they can't at all, actually.
No.
So, yeah, it's just one easy step we can take to at least slow the spread of this insect and kind of hamper its growth.
I don't know about other states, but in Minnesota, you do get a pretty hefty fine if they catch you moving firewood. Mm-hmm. So there's another reason to not do it.
You will.
If they catch you, it's... I think it's at least several hundred dollars if they catch you moving a bunch of firewood around or something.
I know there's a certain mile limit in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think it's
50 miles or something like that.
So it also. Yeah. So, yeah, just something to think about. It's not only, I mean, the underlying point is it's just good practice. If everyone does that, we can actually really, slow the spread of things like the emerald ash borer.
Right. Other things too. I mean,
this is just one example, but
there's a lot of pests that spread this way. Dutch elm disease spread this way just as well. That was proven that it made a huge spread by people moving it.
Right.
We moved it more than any insects did at the time. So I think in this case we're probably moving the insects farther than they would be also. So it's a great comparison in my opinion.
Anything else about the green ash besides that it's awesome?
It's a relatively maintenance-free tree, too, besides the fact that at this point,
any existing
tree is going to need to have trunk injections just to keep it alive for emerald ash borer. If you have a big, nice green ash in your yard, you don't want to lose it.
Consider doing something.
Talk to an arborist about getting insecticide injections. It stays in the tree. It's just fine for the environment. Doesn't go anywhere. So
It stays there, don't worry. Generally, it doesn't suck something out of the trunk of a tree.
Yeah, it doesn't come out of the trunk into the leaves.
It just sits there, but
yeah, it's only there if the insects start boring into the tree and eating that
the wood that has the insecticide in it.
Right, then the insects.
So don't eat your tree.
Yeah, I guess that would be a safety message, I suppose. But yeah, no, point being, if you have a tree in your yard, it's likely not resistant. Like, so,
don't count on it being half a percent that's going
to
make it.
Right, do definitely have it injected if you would like to save it. It's a good option. It can extend its life for quite a while.
Yeah.
But otherwise...
especially if the tree adds value to your house.
Exactly,
you can pay $1,000, but you get a $6,000 benefit because you have a gorgeous big ash tree in your backyard.
Value to the house, for, you know, it might provide energy benefits like we've talked about before. So, yeah, we know trees can add a lot of value. So.
Something to look into because it's also going to cost you $600 to take it down.
Right, yeah, it's going to be expensive if you want it removed anyway, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good option to consider if you have a nice ash. So, I think that's all we have to say this time. Let's wrap this up.
Next week we'll be talking about, like we said, the Emerald Ash Borer, so make sure you come back and join us for that.
Yeah.
And then our species highlight, I think we were going to do blue ash.
Yeah, we're going to move right on to one of the Emerald Ash Borer resistant species next time.
Yeah, it'll be a real fun time. And please share your comments, thoughts, questions, insults in the comments, or give us an email.
Yeah, we welcome it all.
Yeah, we won't get too upset about most things. And you've been listening to Treetop Talks, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening.